The case of Hall versus Commonwealth. And just as a reminder, has everyone signed in their signature?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, good. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Matthew Pack representing Tina Hall. And if I may reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
2 minutes, yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, let me start by saying that when we filed this appeal, Courier v. Virginia was still working its way through the Supreme Court. And as we all know, the decision was announced by the United States Supreme Court on June 22nd, 2018. And certainly, we understand the propositions of what it stands for, and our argument obviously would be that notwithstanding that, we're still certainly making a good faith argument against some of the law announced in that 5-4 decision. With Courier, Justice Gorsuch released a majority opinion and says that if a defendant consents to or in some way waives joinder of indictments that are brought as one set of indictments, then they waive their right to collaterally attack such indictments if they're acquitted on in a previous trial. In this case, we make no bones about it. We moved for severance. And I think the record's pretty clear about that. And I would just say to the court, and certainly it's a policy thing as much as anything else, Virginia is distinct from some of the other jurisdictions that were represented by the states as the United States Supreme Court in that our jury system decides punishment, and we have bifurcated jury trials. So my client, as well as several other clients, and the criminal defendants, have a kind of no-win situation in that either the jury gets to hear about a previous conviction or they move to sever. And unfortunately, that's the no-win choice that you have to make. And so in this case, we strategically made the decision to move to sever in order to preserve that issue and keep the jury from hearing about the previous conviction and unreasonably being tainted by that. Now, the issue that makes this a little bit different than Courier, and I know there's a slight difference, is that the previous jury trial prior to the trial on the possession of the firearm, the previous jury trial was actually ruled on a motion strike, which is a little bit different than Courier. Courier was an acquittal by a jury, which we know is kind of a general verdict. In this case, the previous trial, the court granted a motion to strike made by defense counsel for a possession with intent to distribute third or subsequent and a possession while possessing a firearm. Those were the two charges before the court. And the court granted the motion to strike and said that there was no possession. Now, what we wanted to be able to do is to come in and file the motion to dismiss and file it for collateral estoppel, according to Ash, according to Blockberger, in our case. And the trial court said, well, there's this Courier case out there, and at that time it had not been ruled on, and it says that if it's part of the same scheme of indictments, that the Court of Appeals had said that you can't collaterally then attack it. And so we challenged that and then went forward in trial. We would also say to your honors this morning that...
As a practical yes. matter, just to follow up on your
sure.
interesting point there, as a practical matter, though, what would be the difference from a collateral estoppel standpoint of an acquittal by a jury and a trial judge's granting a motion to strike?
Great question, Your Honor. The difference there is that an acquittal by a jury says, they don't know why you found him guilty. And that's some of the things that they point to in the Courier opinion. When the defendant gives such consent for the case to be severed, we don't really know why a jury may do that. And the Commonwealth, and going to our second argument, is that we think collateral estoppel should be available criminally, even though the court in their opinion says it might not. But the difference is that in a motion to strike, the court rules and makes a ruling that the evidence is not sufficient to go forward for this reason. The Commonwealth is not made out a prima facie case for this reason. And in that case, and in the particular case previous to this, the court said the reason for this was is that there was a lack of possession. And so then we take that particular issue, and we've said that, well,
it was a lack of possession of the drugs, and therefore you couldn't be in possession of a firearm while possessing drugs.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And so
you could potentially be a felon still in possession of a firearm.
Correct. That we certainly understand that. But we've said that at least we should be able to argue the fact that there's a lack of possession. And that lack of possession of the contraband, be it the drugs, be it the firearm, it was all located in the same place. So the very specific ruling for the motion to strike should be able to be used in a motion to dismiss for collateral estoppel and collaterally attack that particular ruling. Because it is a finality, and it is a finality of judgments. I know the courts have recently had the Court of Appeals recently ruled on a case with finality of judgments. And, you know, in order to, that's our second argument, that number one is that we believe that, again, going, and we understand what Courier stands for, but we believe that it is unfair to put the defendant in a no-win situation to where they have to choose whether the jury hears about this previous conviction or...
But I guess, you know, let's just, I mean, not to go down this, because Courier's there, both from this court and then from the Supreme Court of Virginia and Supreme Court of the United States, but if it weren't there, why would it even be collateral estoppel, given that your client, you concede that she had had previous felony convictions, and if the court could have found her in possession of the firearm, as the court did when it was tried separately, why would that be a collateral estoppel by simply finding she couldn't have been in possession of a firearm while possessing drugs if they didn't think she possessed the drugs?
Your Honor, it would be our contention that it's all located in the same vicinity where law enforcement says the drugs are located in this vicinity, all right, in this one bedroom of this one house. So if you don't possess those drugs, then how in the world would you be able to possess a firearm in those? And logically, it makes no sense. Either you're there in that room and you've been able to possess or constructively possess those drugs in that firearm, or you can't. And that would be our argument. We weren't even able to get to that point.
It was all there together, essentially.
Correct, Your Honor.
But why couldn't a fact finder conclude that the boyfriend, the father of her child, was a drug dealer this time, or at least he was the one dealing with the drugs, but that given everything found in the room and the AK-47 by the bed where they found her little boy in the bed next to the AK-47, why couldn't they find, oh, well, we think she did possess or was in constructive possession of the firearm?
Well, again, because it's either you believe that the drugs and the gun are all part of one or they're not. And with this particular instance, as the court's probably seen with the facts in this case, they obviously shared custody. And it was our contention that my client lived at another location. And certainly the child's there.
I guess that just...
It's just a factual issue.
Right.
But our legal argument is that the drugs found in the room, the court made a specific ruling that there was not possession. It's found in the... I mean, within feet, maybe inches, of where this alleged firearm is. And so if you find that there is no possession of such, I just don't understand logically how you wouldn't say, well, there's no possession of the firearm as well. And... That's our second argument, obviously.
Before you move on to the second argument, I'm still having a little bit of trouble figuring out how you're making a legal distinction for purposes of the Courier analysis between the motion to strike and a jury verdict.
Well, a jury verdict...
I mean, a jury verdict is a not guilty.
Right. But what is the reason for the not guilty, Your Honor? And that's our distinction. And that's what Courier kind of points out, that it puts... For the collateral estoppel argument, it puts, as far as the Commonwealth, it puts them in a distinct position because they can't appeal for double jeopardy purpose. They can't appeal a not guilty verdict. But a not guilty verdict is...
Can't appeal a motion to strike either.
Correct, Your Honor. But the motion to strike is very distinct. The court announces why the court has struck this particular charge and the reasons for it. And the court didn't announce that. I'm sorry?
Not always. Sometimes they just grant it or deny it, right?
Certainly. In this case, Your Honor, the court did announce exactly why the motion to strike was granted. And I would also offer the court, it is, and this court's obviously put forward the proposition that if counsel, and when making a motion to strike, obviously we have to make it at the close of evidence in a criminal case, and if we put on evidence, we have to renew such. If we don't do that with specificity at both parts, then we haven't preserved our argument. So I would argue that we make our arguments, even if the court says granted, we make an argument for a very specific purpose. And so a motion to strike is much different than a general jury verdict. And that would be our distinction, Your Honor. Certainly we understand the Currier verdict, or the Currier opinion, and it's our argument against that. And Currier seems to indicate that collateral estoppel is not available to the criminal defendant, and we would argue that it should be, especially in cases of this, and especially in jurisdictions such as the Commonwealth of Virginia with bifurcated juries and the jury recommending sentence. And there's four things that, as the court is well aware of, that in order to prove collateral estoppel, the parties have to be the same. The factual issue sought to be litigated has to be actually litigated in the prior proceeding. The factual issue must have been essential to the judgment rendered for the prior proceeding, and the prior proceeding must have resulted in a valid final judgment against whom the parties sought for the doctrine to be applied. And in this case, again, going back to previous argument, we would argue that you can't have the drugs and the gun because it's literally within the same, the evidence shows it's in the same spot. And when the court rules that there's no possession, we believe that that obviously could be collaterally attacked under collateral estoppel and ask the court to extend that. Finally, we would go to our sufficiency of the evidence argument. And with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, it's a constructive possession, obviously. And there was viable testimony by a third-party witness that my client didn't live at that residence. And so in order to have constructive possession, as we know, you have to have knowledge.
But the fact finder doesn't have to believe that testimony, right?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And I read your client's response in the testimony, and she seems to have a hard time explaining why that shoebox with all those titles, certificates of title to the vehicles, are organized up under that bed as well. She explains her medication. She hadn't taken that medication, she said, in a long time. But, and then is it the Cuban? I'm not saying that right. That shows she owns these vehicles and lists this address as her address. So, looking at all that, why couldn't a rational fact finder come to the conclusion that she was living there?
Well, we would say that the third party witness, and certainly the court is right, but you can't, the court can't, or the fact finder can't just disregard credible testimony. And I think that's what that obviously comes down to, Your Honor. Is the credibility of that particular witness. And with regard to the evidence found in that room, I would agree with the court. She certainly does waffle as to how those things are there. But certainly we understand that there are college students that have maybe an address in Lynchburg and they go to school in Blacksburg and they may live at a residence in Blacksburg. She had the father of her child that resided at that particular location. So for those very reasons in the previous argument, we would ask the court to grant our appeal. Thank you.
Colonel, thank you. Ms. Dunn-Curio.
May it please the court, Brittany Dunn-Curio for the Commonwealth. The evidence was sufficient to establish that Hall possessed the firearm, and there are no double jeopardy violations in this case. Hall had the awareness of both the presence and nature of the firearm. On the day the police executed the search warrant, she told two police officers, that she knew that Ronnie had possessed the firearm and that he received it from his father 2 months previously for the purposes of protection. She also had dominion and control over the firearm. There's a reasonable inference that Hall resided at 1105 Cody Road. She claimed the address on her DMV records. She claimed possession of multiple cars in the asset forfeiture response or answer. She had a repair bill with her address listed as 1105 Cody Road. Police observed her at the house twice in 1 week. A week previous to the execution of the search warrant, she was seen in the afternoon when Ronnie wasn't home. And then that morning, she was seen leaving the house between 7:30 in the morning and 8:30 in the morning when the police were conducting their pre-search surveillance. She also admitted that she stayed the night at the house, and many of her personal belongings were found in the room. It's also clear from the evidence that she had access to the room itself. The firearm was located in the bedroom between a nightstand and between the bed. And to the left of the firearm, in the first drawer of the nightstand, contained the magazine for the gun, and it also contained keys to one of her vehicles that was found on the property. On the bed, her child was on top of it when the police entered the room. Underneath the bed contained a very large firearm box for this AK-47, for this 3-foot-long box. And next to the box under the bed, there was a shoe box which contained, I think it was 4 of her vehicle titles, and it also, underneath the bed, there were at least 2 pieces of her mail. In the bedroom, on the dresser, it contained her child's insurance card, it contained his bottle, and it contained 2 of her prescriptions. And on the ground, on page 323 of the appendix, you can see that there is what appears to be a female flip-flop and underwear on the ground as well.
Well, the fact that the defendant may well have been living there and had personal effects that were in the close proximity to the firearm, does that take us beyond mere proximity? Mere proximity is not enough, is it, to show exercise of dominion or control?
The mere proximity is not enough, but I think this does take us beyond that, especially because she was seen leaving the house in the morning and she knew where the firearm was located, or she knew that there was a firearm in the house.
She knew the firearm was there, and that, for purposes of this argument, we can assume what was her residence, but is that more than mere proximity?
Yes, and I think in this case there's a reasonable assumption or a reasonable inference that can be made that she was spending the night at that house because she left so early in the morning, and her testimony was not credible in this case. And the trial court found that her testimony wasn't credible when he chose to take what the officers said her statements were to them and rejected hers.
Does the record tell us how many of the vehicles that residence belonged to her, to her home?
There were numerous vehicles. I know the asset forfeiture, I think, said that she claimed ownership of 5 of them. And then I think I remember reading that somewhere else it said 8 were hers. There are numerous vehicles on the property that were hers.
But the record, just to follow up on something you said a moment ago, the record does show that the keys found in the bedroom in that drawer in the nightstand were hers.
Yes, it does.
Counsel, can you address the legal distinction that opposing counsel has made with regard to Currier, the difference between a motion to strike and a jury verdict, and how that might be legally significant?
So I don't think that there is a legal distinction between the two. And in this case, we know what the reasons were for the trial court's denial of the granting of the motion to strike. And that was all based on the possession of the cocaine. And here, this charge didn't involve cocaine possession at all. Also, the record is silent as to where cocaine was located, or marijuana, what any drugs were located in the house. We don't have a copy of the transcript from the original or the first trial, and so I have no idea where it was located. And I think that was just something to point out.
So the drugs that are shown are prescription drugs that we see in the appendix here, not cocaine or marijuana.
No, they're prescription drugs. I didn't see any photos at all that show the presence of cocaine in the bedroom or anywhere in the house. I don't know where they would have been. And I think Currier has decided this issue because a defendant who chooses to sever the charges for the benefit of himself to reducing prejudice cannot later then successfully argue a double jeopardy claim. And even under a more like an Ash analysis, again, the ultimate issues in this case appear to be different. It appears to be cocaine possession, and here we have firearm possession. If there are no further questions, the Commonwealth asks that this court affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you. Mr. Pack, your remaining minute.
I have pretty much finished my argument. If there are any other questions that the court may have, I can address them in my final minute.
Hearing none.
All right. Thank you. We would just ask the court to overrule the trial court and remand. Thank you.
All right. In keeping with the tradition of this court, we